Chapter 1. Your life in your hands. I am often struck by the dangerous narcissism fostered by spiritual rhetoric that pays so much attention to individual self-improvement and so little to the practice of love within the context of community. Bell Hooks. We gotta keep each other alive any way we can, because nobody else is going to do it. Larry Mitchell. In November 2021, the therapy app BetterHelp partnered with rapper and record producer Travis Scott after 10 people died and hundreds were injured in a crowd surge at his Astroworld Festival in Houston, Texas. Prior to the 50,000 people event, local authorities had expressed safety concerns, and following the disaster, Scott and the organizers faced numerous lawsuits claiming negligence and incitement. In response to the tragedy, Scott offered gig attendees 1 month of free therapy on BetterHelp. Controversy ensued, as BetterHelp and Scott were accused of profiting off people's suffering. Though Scott denied being paid for the brand partnership, Astroworld grossed $53.5 million in 2019, he could afford not to, the offer was nonetheless part of a marketing strategy. Scott's press release after the Astroworld disaster read, "Travis is grateful to be working alongside BetterHelp, a renowned mental health service provider." However, BetterHelp, the Uber of mental health services, is notorious. The app's own website has a footnote regarding its therapeutic limitations. "If you are in crisis or any other person may be in danger, don't use this site," reads the ambiguous disclaimer. In exchange for a monthly charge of around £200 to £300 per month, BetterHelp enables people seeking mental health support to communicate with a therapist in a 24/7 room, using video calls, phone calls, live chats, and text messages. In reviews of BetterHelp, people share stories alleging unhelpful or harmful therapy, data privacy concerns, excessive charges, and having their sessions suddenly terminated. If it is difficult to regulate in-person therapy, it is even harder on an app. BetterHelp's terms of service reads, in capital letters, "You hereby release us and agree to hold us harmless from any and all causes of action and claims of any nature resulting from the therapist's services or the platform, including, without limitation, any act, omission, opinion, response, advice, suggestion, information, and/or service of any therapist." Raising complaints with BetterHelp might prove difficult. Help is mostly algorithmically managed. For therapists, BetterHelp is gig economy work, unpredictable and highly demanding, with much lower rates of pay than other avenues of employment. BetterHelp's partnership with Travis Scott is part of the platform's established advertising strategy, often involving marketing deals with Instagram influencers and celebrities. In 2018, scandal hit the app after well-known YouTubers began creating BetterHelp-sponsored content, baring their souls on camera before urging viewers to sign up to the therapy platform, earning them commission via affiliate links. A backlash accused such sponsorship deals of being unethical and BetterHelp of being a scam. As the lethal chaos unfolded at Astroworld, young fans shared horrifying videos on TikTok of people, moments before in post-pandemic ecstasy, being crushed in the crowd, their guttural pleas for help drowned out by the music. In Ghosts of My Life, Writings on Depression, Hauntology and Lost Futures, the cultural critic and theorist Mark Fisher posits that hip-hop might be where the secret sadness lurking behind the 21st century's forced smile has registered most deeply. Popular artists such as Kanye West and Drake, who performed with Scott at Astroworld, he suggests, are morbidly fixated on exploring the miserable hollowness at the core of super-affluent hedonism. What Fisher calls the hedonist sadness of the conspicuous consumer drenches the Astroworld footage. In one YouTube clip, entitled "The Moment Travis Scott Knew There Was Something Wrong in the Audience," viewed almost a million times, the star, having paused the show, appears to briefly leave his body, gazing in terror at the desperate situation. Moments later, he screams for everyone to make this motherfucking ground shake. Once again, urgent cries are rendered futile as Scott begins to perform the eerie "Lost Forever," which includes lyrics promoting Dior. "It's hard not to hear," writes Fisher, "demands that we enjoy ourselves as thin attempts to distract from a depression that they can only mask, never dissipate." How are we doing? The collision of obligatory peak enjoyment with profound suffering is characteristic of social forces that compel success and happiness while materially producing impoverished lives, whether economically, socially, or spiritually. Meaningful statistics on rates of mental illness over time are hard to come by because of changing understandings and diagnoses, as well as the inconsistency with which people self-report symptoms in surveys. However, many studies show that depression and anxiety rates have increased greatly over the past few decades, especially since the 1980s. In 2019, the suicide rate for men hit a two-decade high. The COVID-19 pandemic has brought mental health to the fore. According to data from the Office for National Statistics, 1 in 5 people now experience moderate to severe symptoms of depression, with women, young people, poor people, and disabled people most impacted, compared to 1 in 10 before the pandemic. Another study by Mind shows that existing inequalities in housing, employment, finances, and other areas made the mental health impact of the pandemic worse for racialized groups. 10 million people, including 1.5 million children, will likely require new or additional mental health support as a direct result of the crisis, according to the Royal College of Psychiatrists, or RCP. Meanwhile, RCP President Adrian James described the pandemic as likely being the biggest hit to mental health since the Second World War. Even before these statistics were available, government communications, as well as corporate advertising, harnessing a general sense that a global pandemic, mass death, widespread fear, increased hardship, domestic isolation, and repeated lockdowns were likely to do something to people's psychological well-being, told us to check in on each other and stay connected. To the state, this meant, keep calm and carry on as we kill you. To advertisers, it meant, buy this to make your isolation, dread, and sickness more bearable. Under capitalism, mental health is understood as a personal failing, rather than the result of societal forces. Someone who is depressed, for example, is likely to find their depression is theorized by institutions and authorities, such as the medical profession, bosses, the Department for Work and Pensions, and often their family, as an individualized problem. Depression may be understood as a lack of get up and go, an inability to get over difficult experiences, or perhaps as only a chemical imbalance that can be remedied by the person's own efforts or medication alone. Acknowledging the social causes of mental illness or distress, by contrast, allows us to consider how the world is making us unwell. In turn, this may alleviate suffering and energize resistance because, as Fisher writes, depression is partly constituted by a sneering inner voice which accuses you of self-indulgence. You aren't depressed. You're just feeling sorry for yourself. Pull yourself together. Of course, this voice isn't an inner voice at all. It is the internalized expression of actual social forces, some of which have a vested interest in denying any connection between depression and politics. When David Cameron became Prime Minister in 2010, placing the country in Tory hands from which it has yet to escape, his government implemented austerity measures in welfare, healthcare, and education that would intensify the stress and struggle of people's lives in the aftermath of the longest and deepest recession in a generation. Papering over the material and psychological impact of such measures, Cameron also vowed to increase the nation's well-being with a happiness agenda. Thus, the government claimed to care about people's well-being while simultaneously inflicting mental torture via neoliberal economic policies. According to recent research, procedures for out-of-work benefit claims became more institutionally violent between 2010 and 2015, with psychological harm used as a technique to deter claimants and avoid paying them. Carrying out in-depth interviews with frontline workers and managers in public and contracted employment services, the researchers uncovered an array of policy tools and hidden managerial methods used during the coalition administration, which encouraged frontline staff to deliver services in ways that led to a range of harmful outcomes for benefit claimants in the attempt to coerce them into work. People claiming benefits during this time reported mental illness being precipitated or exacerbated by such a regime, and nothing has improved since. The benefit system overall is still shaped by reforms introduced from 2010. Indeed, since welfare tends to become more punitive in periods following a major crisis, such as a pandemic-induced recession, the system of state support will continue inflicting, likely increasing, harm. Margaret Thatcher once stated that economics are the method, the object is to change the heart and soul. Since human hearts and souls cannot be subsumed into the logic of capital without alienation and varying types and degrees of immiseration, the changes Thatcher refers to could in part be understood as mental illness. In this vein, the 1970s revolutionary therapy collective Red Therapy described mental illness as a major form of reaction of our body's rebellion against capitalism. The need to sell our labour power for a wage in order to survive causes suffering, whether we are unemployed, underemployed, in in-work poverty, enduring poor working conditions, underpaid, unpaid or overworked, or in a combination of these states. Work as we know it is our poisonous lifeblood. Most people spend a large proportion of their waking hours working, and much of their free time exhausted by work. According to some analyses, the pandemic has woken many up to this tragedy. People are quitting their jobs in record numbers in what has been dubbed the Great Resignation. Sadly, for most of us, there is no escaping labour, and the future of work looks bleak. The 2010s were the worst decade for real wage growth since the Napoleonic Wars, and stagnation is projected to continue. Work is increasingly precarious and insecure, with people facing intense competition for jobs they don't want, and anxiety about automation rendering their skills obsolete. The gig economy, in which workers are even more disposable, harder to unionise, and have fewer rights and protections, is booming, while the boundaries between work and home and work and free time are becoming increasingly blurry. The pressure to self-commodify is intense, whether by accruing positive reviews on the apps we depend upon for work, or by constructing strong personal branding on social media. This phenomenon is captured by psychoanalyst and philosopher Eric Fromm's concept of the marketing character, experiencing oneself as a commodity and one's value not as use value, but as exchange value, which serves as a source of alienation, spiritual depletion and suffering. The idea of human life as capital needing to accrue value is instilled from childhood, especially so in millennials, argues Malcolm Harris in Kids These Days, with anxiety and depression among young people consequently significantly higher than in previous generations. The increasing flexibilization of work might be considered capitalism's appropriation of growing anti-work sentiment. "I choose to work around my social life," reads a London Underground poster advert for Gig, the flexible working app. "Damalola has 140 gigs," claims the advert, including COVID-19 tester, warehouse operative, and customer care steward. This facade of freedom is anything but. In neoliberalism, suggests the political theorist Franco Berardi in Precarious Rhapsody, the person is free, sure, but his time is enslaved. His liberty is a juridical fiction to which nothing in concrete daily life corresponds. At work, people are increasingly subject to anxiety-inducing surveillance via technologies that quantify their productivity, and sometimes purportedly their health and well-being. Amazon has become the malignant poster child for the widespread reality of soul-crushing micromanagement, with its targets that leave delivery workers no time to use the toilet, or its patented wristbands designed to maximise warehouse productivity by tracking workers' every move, using haptic feedback vibrations to steer their bodies. The combination of precarity with intensifying self-quantification and digital connectivity creates constant attentive stress, writes Berardi, and a reduced time available for effectivity, which provokes an effect of devastation on the individual psyche: depression, panic, anxiety, the sense of solitude and existential misery. This is not a personal inability to cope, he emphasises, but a growing mass of existential misery that is tending always more to explode in the centre of the social system. In lives dominated by work, in treadmill-like cities, full of people yet defined by segregation and isolation, people often experience feelings of alienation. The dominant architecture is designed to protect and facilitate profit. Office blocks replace social housing, gated developments are marketed to individuals, couples and nuclear families. Designing out crime, police officers influence the built environment to minimise social interaction. A sense of security among loving community is hard to come by, and solidarity with our neighbours perhaps even harder. Beyond casual greetings or the odd excuse me or sorry or thank you or fuck you, speaking to each other, let alone caring for each other outside of private homes, transactions, workplaces, or planned socialising, is uncommon, even considered suspect. We live with the knowledge that the economic system in which we exist is wreaking havoc on our planet. The most recent global climate summit failed to produce an agreement that will limit temperature increases to below 2 degrees centigrade, a rise that will devastate life on Earth. With people living in the global south and low-income marginalised groups facing much higher threats to their health and survival. Ecological crisis is linked to somatic and psychic crisis. Air pollution, for example, damages our bodies systematically, harming every organ, almost every cell, and our mental health. A recent study found a clear relationship between rising temperatures and suicide rates, and clear evidence for the climate crisis exacerbating mental distress. The researchers also found that mentally ill people are more vulnerable to the health effects of climate change, and that the climate crisis threatens to disrupt existing mental health care. The depletion of the planet correlates with the depletion of ourselves, writes literary critic Mikael Krauss-Franson. The perpetual mobile of capital and its exhaustion of resources also pertains to mental resources. The economic and the psychological seem to have become indistinguishable from each other, as the double meaning of depression would also suggest. Meanwhile, dominant culture preaches happiness, with ourselves and with the world, as aspirational, selling us avenues to wellness. In The Happiness Industry, William Davies argues that the elusive feeling of happiness is increasingly monitored and manipulated through surveillance technologies, algorithmic advertising, and psychological profiling by state and corporate bodies to produce docile and efficient subjects. This kind of happiness is vacuous, proclaiming, as self-described black lesbian mother warrior poet Audre Lorde put it in the Cancer Journals, let us seek joy rather than real food and clean air and a saner future on a livable earth, as if happiness alone can protect us from the results of profit madness. The joy we are supposed to seek is associated with some life paths and not others. As Sara Ahmed writes in The Promise of Happiness, theorists have long shown how happiness is used to justify oppression and to re-describe social norms as social goods in feminist critiques of the figure of the happy housewife, black critiques of the myth of the happy slave, and queer critiques of the sentimentalization of heterosexuality as domestic bliss. Fighting to overthrow the system would feel like a salve for the suffering of life under capitalism. But revolutionary work can also leave us depleted. It might even feel impossible or futile. Dissent is increasingly prevented and punished by the state with tactics such as surveillance, stop and search, police raids, mass arrests, and tighter border controls. Passed in April 2022, the Police, Crime, Sentencing and Courts Act is now stifling resistance further, having increased police powers and created new offences criminalising protest. Political depression, writes Anne Savetkovich in Depression, A Public Feeling, is the sense that customary forms of political response, including direct action and critical analysis, are no longer working either to change the world or to make us feel better. For some people, this effective state might entail despair or inertia. For others, it might lead them to reactionary politics. Fisher considered the rise of the far right, including the social mood resulting in Brexit and the rise of Trump, as a counterforce to increasing resignation about depressing living conditions, a last-ditch attempt at upending them at whatever cost. There is a connection between capitalist realism and depressive realism, writes Fisher. The idea that life is essentially drudgery and that therefore no one should get a free ride is a depressive conception of fairness. If I have to be miserable, so should everyone else, which has a particular traction in a burnt-out post-Protestant culture like England's. England is the oldest capitalist country, don't forget. Are you getting help? Comprehending suffering as a collective experience and locating its origins in the system around us may help us to understand ourselves and each other and to lessen the burden of mainstream, individualising discourses on mental health. But, as Savetkovich writes, saying that capitalism or colonialism or racism is the problem does not help me get up in the morning. While some stridently believe that mental illness is a personal problem, and others just as ardently that it is capitalism's fault, it can also be understood as biopsychosocial, caused by an interconnection of biological factors such as hormones, psychological factors such as trauma history, and social factors such as racism. Whatever the reasons we suffer, our options for support usually range from woefully inadequate to actively harmful. A decade of austerity has wrought havoc on people's well-being, at the same time as decimating NHS mental health services, which face a severe lack of funding and resources. Disappearing community services, staff shortages, and growing waiting lists mean that it can be near impossible to access vital support. As recently revealed by The Guardian, the NHS is paying £2 billion a year to private hospitals to receive mental health patients because of bed shortages, despite concerns that these institutions are routinely unsafe. Aside from the scarce free or low-cost options made available by some private practices, appropriate and effective therapeutic options are mostly reserved for those with the money, time, and resources to access them. And even then, being in therapy isn't necessarily therapeutic. As members of society, therapists can and do reinforce hateful ideologies such as racism, transphobia, and whorephobia, demonstrating that they're not apolitical, as they might claim, at all. For those unable to access private therapists, NHS Talking Therapy is available through Improving Access to Psychological Therapies, or IAPT, services, launched by Tony Blair's happiness czar, Lord Richard Layard, in 2008. Replacing many other forms of counselling and psychotherapy offered by GP surgeries and the third sector, most of the free therapy provision in the UK is now short-term cognitive behavioural therapy, or CBT, often outsourced to private companies. CBT adopts a medicalised, evidence-based approach to mental illness, aiming to treat negative thought patterns as symptoms of diagnoses such as social phobia or panic disorder as quickly as possible. Whilst helpful for some people, the use of CBT can be motivated by getting people off benefits and back to work, rather than exploring the roots of suffering in personal histories and social contexts. CBT as a one-size-fits-all approach fails many. Of those deemed suitable for treatment with IAPT, those with symptoms that aren't judged to be too severe, complex, or persistent, around half receive one-to-one talking therapy. Increasingly, low-intensity therapies are offered, online or via apps. And even though, according to many measures, Black people, with experiences of intergenerational trauma and racism, experience higher levels of mental distress, they are less likely to receive NHS therapy. The apparent success of IAPT is quantified in performance data that includes a recovery rate measured in terms of caseness, that is, whether the patient is considered a clinical case at the end of their treatment, as measured by algorithmic scores derived from diagnostic questionnaires. Questions on the generalized anxiety disorder scale ask people how often, 0, not at all, to 3, nearly every day, they have been. For example, worrying too much about different things or feeling afraid as if something awful might happen. Being recovered means scoring lower on these diagnostic questionnaires after a period of therapy. Whilst acknowledging that IAPT services help some people simply by providing a space for their feelings to be heard, the psychotherapist Paul Atkinson, who helps to run the Free Psychotherapy Network, considers the quantifications of recovery in CBT assembly line fixes for the madness of living under neoliberalism. Symptoms that this kind of therapy might consider mental illness could, rather, be seen as sane responses to being alive in the world. What is worrying too much about different things if we are struggling to pay our rent and feed our children, or facing transphobia that makes being in public space frightening? How do we maintain an awareness of the gravity of the ecological crisis, and so organise for climate justice, without feeling afraid as if something awful might happen? How can the ability to work be considered recovery if it is work that is making us sick? Despite the state of the world, we are pushed, even coerced, towards wellness. The self-care industry markets solutions to suffering based on a pro-capitalist conception of wellness. Good self-care might include signing up to yoga and meditation apps, using skincare products and sex toys, ingesting expensive and foul substances like functional mushroom tea, or watching Netflix. But these activities are only considered healthy if they bolster rather than subtract from the time and or energy we dedicate to work. This understanding of self-care is attached to productivity, or, as feminist activists and scholars Silvia Federici and Nicole Cox put it, to preparing ourselves for work, restoring our muscles, nerves, bones and brains with quick snacks, quick sex, movies. Included in self-care might be various forms of self-help. On some meditation and mindfulness apps, users offer up personal data, often shared with third parties for advertising or marketing purposes, in exchange for free mental health support. Such apps are sometimes prescribed by employers to serve as mental health support for workers, in lieu of improving the pay or working conditions that may be causing their distress in the first place. Happier people, healthier business, promises the mindfulness app Headspace on its page advertising the platform as the only employee mental health solution for modern organizations that combines a popular science-based application with a program fit for the enterprise. Like the growing popularity of psychedelics in Silicon Valley, self-administered app therapy may in the end amount to a kind of self-development more helpful to profit growth than to emotional growth. No matter how we are feeling, sanity under capitalism is about the willingness and ability to work. The harder, the better. Therapy and self-care might alleviate suffering. They might also be understood as forms of adaptation to, or even collusion with, its underlying causes. The well-balanced person, wrote the philosopher Theodore W. Adorno, would not thereby have achieved an inner resolution of social conflicts because his integration would be a false reconciliation with an unreconciled world. At worst, he conjectured, this kind of false reconciliation could be an identification with the aggressor, a mere character mask of subordination to systems of violence, stifling solidarity and dissent. Staying, or seeming to have stayed, sane, as determined by psychiatrists and state authorities, can be connected to certain privileges. Apparent sanity might be more accessible to people who experience more safety in the world, for example, because they are less likely to experience sexual violence. And for those deemed to have lost it, psychiatric intervention is often carceral. Under powers afforded by the 1983 Mental Health Act, or MHA, police may enter your home by force, physically restrain, arrest, and lock you up, simply because they have decided that, as the NHS website puts it, you appear to have a mental disorder and are in need of immediate care or control. In the Act, mental disorder is defined vaguely as any disorder or disability of the mind. What the state's care or control entails varies greatly depending on the identity of the person concerned. Mental health care for black people is more likely to mean criminalization. In 2020, black people were four times more likely than white people to be detained or sectioned under the MHA, and more likely to suffer poor treatment, abuse, and even death while subject to psychiatric intervention and institutionalization. Detention under the MHA involves a near total removal of consent, including regarding the administration of medication, physical restraint, and freedom of movement, often for years at a time. Psychiatric inpatients in NHS trusts can be subjected to 24/7 video surveillance without their consent. In February 2022, a patient died in Huntercombe Hospital, Maidenhead, a mental health facility for children and teenagers, following its being rated inadequate by the Care Quality Commission in 2021, and repeated reports by patients of restraint that left them covered in bruises. Following the patient's death, a 17-year-old fellow patient started a petition calling for Huntercombe to be closed, describing staff negligence enforced by management on a regular basis, causing innocent young children to die when they are in a place that is supposed to keep us alive. People experiencing mental health crises can also be subjected to a controversial NHS programme called Serenity Integrated Monitoring, or SIM, which began expanding across the UK 5 years ago. A cost-saving measure designed by former police officer Paul Jennings, SIM intends to stop people in distress, often at high risk of self-harm or suicide, from calling upon emergency services. The programme coerces high-intensity users of emergency services into meeting with police officers who are given access to their medical records. These officers are empowered to put pressure on patients to reduce their attention-seeking use of public services, such as ambulances, hospitals, and mental health provision. If individuals do not comply, officers can threaten criminal sanctions, such as community behaviour orders or prison. Most people subjected to this model are women who have been given the highly stigmatised diagnosis of borderline personality disorder, who are often survivors of complex trauma, including sexual violence. The diagnoses that attend psychiatric intervention are political. In the diagnostic process, some people's subjectivities are affirmed, whilst others are denied, attacked, or weaponized against them. Whilst queer people are less likely now than in the past to have their sexuality explicitly pathologized by a therapist, queer women, for example, are much more likely to be diagnosed with borderline personality disorder. Likewise, black men are 10 times more likely than white men to be diagnosed with psychosis. In the mental health charity Mind's submission to the 2018 review of the MHA, a black person with lived experience of the act is quoted as saying, "Racism is steeped deeply within British society and its institutional structures, including the health service. A long history of slavery and colonialism shapes how black people and other minorities are perceived and treated as variously dangerous, childlike, and intellectually inferior, which evokes, at the very least, a paternalism of we know best." In reference to community treatment orders, a controlling and punitive measure for previously sectioned people dubbed psychiatric ASBOs, the submission said that black steering group members experienced the regime as coercive and intrusive while, at the same time, hugely unsupportive, with some seeing it as a form of race surveillance. Many people in severe mental distress, of course, are not detained in psychiatric wards where there is a veneer of treatment, especially if they are men, and even more likely if they are black men. Many are locked up in prisons where suffering people are punished with more suffering. "Whilst deviant women have been constructed as insane," wrote the political activist and scholar Angela Davis in "Are Prisons Obsolete?", "deviant men have been constructed as criminal. Some such men in the UK today are shut away in so-called close supervision centres, or CSCs, a form of solitary confinement representing an even harsher version of the special security units, or SSUs, that Amnesty International has argued constitute cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment. Prisoners in CSCs, among whom self-harm and suicide rates are very high, are locked up for 23, sometimes 24 hours per day and fed through a hatch. No contact is permitted with other prisoners, and they are escorted to exercise and showers by multiple guards in riot gear. The only established temporary exit for prisoners in CSCs is to be sectioned and sent to a high-security psychiatric hospital such as Broadmoor. Despite this, CSCs have been endorsed by the Royal College of Psychiatrists as being eligible for Enabling Environment status, an award for services where everyone thrives, succeeds, and achieves more positive outcomes. Since incarceration exacerbates and precipitates mental illness, mental health practitioners are nowadays often brought into prisons to provide support, so the prison system claims. But prisoners and campaigners say mental health professionals' involvement often amounts to collusion with the system's attempts to control and punish vulnerable people. This claim has historical precedent. Punitive psychiatry has always been used to dominate, delegitimise, and lock up rebellious people, including political dissidents. In 1851, for example, the American doctor Samuel A. Cartwright invented the diagnosis drapetomania to describe the mental disorder of enslaved Africans attempting to free themselves. More recently, as explored by the psychiatrist Jonathan Metzl in The Protest Psychosis, schizophrenia diagnoses have been used to oppress black militancy and defend white supremacy. Societies have long shunned and punished people judged to have transgressed norms of acceptable composure and descended into insanity. In the 1970s, members of the East London Big Flame, a revolutionary socialist feminist group, wrote in their Red Therapy pamphlet, "Defining people as mad or evil as an excuse for putting them away or destroying them has been a common practice since the witches of the Middle Ages and before." In England, as early as the 16th and 17th centuries, houses of correction were used to discipline poor people who were considered mad. Ever since, institutionalisation and incarceration have been used as tools of power over those considered deviant, including those experiencing high levels of mental distress. Antipsychiatry and radical care. Psychiatric abuse led to the rise of the anti-psychiatry movement in the 1960s and 70s. The movement disavowed psychiatry's non-consensual use of drugs and violent treatments, such as electroconvulsive therapy, and critiqued its reliance on a medical model, considering mental distress only in terms of clinical diagnoses rather than as an experience arising in social contexts. The psychiatrist R.D. Lang, among the most recognised people associated with anti-psychiatry, believed that insanity could instead be considered a sane response to an insane world. In 1965, Lang co-founded a community house at Kingsley Hall in East London, aiming to provide an anti-authoritarian alternative to psychiatric hospitals in a therapeutic home for mentally ill people, particularly those impacted by schizophrenia. As a brochure from the time explained, Kingsley Hall was a melting pot, a crucible in which many assumptions about normal-abnormal, conformist-deviant, sane-crazy, experience and behaviour were dissolved. No person gave another tranquilizers or sedatives. Behaviour was feasible, which would have been intolerable elsewhere. It was a place where people could be together and let each other be. Since the inception of anti-psychiatry, propelled by the resistance of other liberation movements, survivor-led and mad liberation groups have proliferated, organising collectively for freedom from sanest depression. In 1969, the People, Not Psychiatry, or PNP network, was founded as a therapeutic alternative to institutionalised mental health interventions. PNP's first non-manifesto, published in the mid-1970s, introduced the network as follows. It is people that are important, people, not psychiatry, and people need people. That is to say, human beings cannot be fully human in isolation from other people. We meet each other as holistic beings, not as role players bearing such labels as social deviant, psychotic, psychiatrist, and so on. We accept each other as we are and for what we are, not for what we expect of each other. Everyone's experience and lifestyle is accepted as valid for them. PNP House was a squat inspired by Kingsley Hall, where people in mental distress attempted to find respite and healing through communal living and mutual aid. Indeed, anti-psychiatry and mental health service user and survivor-led movements frequently overlap with other radical experiments and struggles. In the 1970s, the Red Lesbian Brigade, an autonomous group of gay liberation front members, graffitied and flyered psychiatric hospitals, including the Maudsley in London, to protest the pathologization of homosexuality and attendant conversion therapy. Their leaflets read, "We are not sick. We are not abnormal. We are not immature. Stop making a fat living out of saying we are. We are strong. We are beautiful. Power to the patients. We don't need you." Today, mental health service user or survivor-led movements continue to fight for liberation. Recovery in the Bin, or RITB, is a critical theory and activism collective resisting the neoliberal medical model's co-option of recovery as a method to control and discipline people experiencing mental distress. RITB believes that in a world of intolerable social and economic conditions, such as poor housing, poverty, stigma, racism, sexism, unreasonable work expectations, and countless other barriers, meaningful recovery is not always possible or even desirable, at least in the terms set out by the medical model, which recognises only a narrow ideology of recovery compatible with normative markers of success, according to which work is a moral standard. The growing mad liberation movement is abolitionist, often fighting in tandem with struggles against police, prisons, and other forms of incarceration, such as immigration detention and deportation. The Campaign for Psychiatric Abolition, or CPA, for example, is a collective of psychiatric survivors fighting against the harm of psychiatry, policing, and incarceration. Since psychiatry is tied up with the racist state and other forms of oppression inherent to the capitalist system, such as transphobia, for the CPA, psychiatric abolition is inextricably linked to anti-capitalism and liberation for all. The CPA and other survivor-led groups often support Mad Pride, a movement reclaiming madness from the clutches of pathologizing discourses and disempowering psychiatric practices. Inspired by gay pride, Mad Pride marches aim to make the violence faced by mental health service users and psychiatric survivors visible. Bed push actions, during which hospital beds are wheeled through public spaces, symbolize escape, the freeing of each other, from a carceral psychiatric system. Mad pride might also mean rethinking diagnoses. For example, as the author Meg John Barker suggests, what was once known as multiple personality disorder, now dissociative identity disorder, can be reconceived using queer theory and alternative therapeutic approaches such as transpersonal psychotherapy to celebrate rather than problematize plural and fluid experiences of self as common, if not universal, ways of being a person in the world. There are alternatives to the medical model, mainstream forms of therapy, and institutionalization for people experiencing emotional distress. Radical alternatives seek to recognize and address the causes of mental illness in the world, not only to remedy the symptoms and to help people survive when conditional state support is either inaccessible, inadequate, or re-traumatizing. People at the sharp end of multiple forms of oppression demonstrate how community care, in everyday acts of embodied solidarity, keeps more people alive and more people well. The Queer Care Network is a transfeminist autonomous care organization providing training, support, and advocacy for queer and trans people, aiming to build communities in which people know how to look after each other with the necessary resources, from nutritious food to medical equipment to legal support. On the front lines of patriarchal capitalism, facing stigma and exclusion in mainstream services and state violence and criminalization, sex workers too demonstrate the power of community care. Mutual aid among sex workers includes organizing meetups to share information and resources, building community safety networks online, unionizing to take back power from exploitative bosses, and starting hardship funds and workers' co-ops during times of crisis, as many sex worker groups, for example, the Sex Worker Advocacy and Resistance Movement and United Sex Workers, have done during the COVID-19 pandemic. Whilst it is true that the concept of community can be useful to capital, particularly with the idea that people should fill the gaps of ever-disintegrating state support, as seen with the Tories' Big Society, an ideology premised on a neoliberal devolution of responsibility from the state to local communities, community care is vital, and the grassroots resilience and networks of interdependence it supports foment counterpower to the state that makes survival a struggle. In an atomized and divided society, however, many people are not part of anything resembling community. Fisher questioned the idealization of the concept for this reason, instead proposing care without community, asking, isn't that what we want? Where you can give people care regardless of whether they belong to the community? Radical care, then, could also be understood as collective, insisting upon well-being as a shared responsibility. Therapeutic practices themselves can integrate liberatory values and approaches and be a part of political organizing. For example, therapists in the Radical Therapist Network are committed to building intersectional, trauma-informed, anti-racist, anti-capitalist, and anti-oppressive therapeutic praxis, and have set up a fund to enable queer, trans, and intersex Black people, Indigenous people, and people of colour to receive free weekly talking therapy for a year, and to train therapist members to deliver intersectional, anti-oppressive, gender and sexuality affirming, trauma-informed, trans-cultural therapy with a particular focus on anti-racist and anti-capitalist therapeutic practice. Unlike many conventional approaches, such therapy necessarily pays attention to the material realities and positionalities of people's lives. Therapy that supports liberation struggles breaks down hierarchy. Rather than the disordered or sick patient and the sane or well professional, the starting point might be, if one of us is suffering, we are all suffering. From feminist consciousness-raising groups, to men's groups, to group therapy, to co-counseling, experiments abound in therapeutic spaces that seek to both tug at the root causes of suffering as well as soothe its everyday aches. An anti-capitalist politics of depression, Franson argues, must reject the neoliberal responsabilization of the depressed subject and instead collectivize suffering, externalize blame, communize care. Franson quotes Franco Berardi, who claims that, in the days to come, politics and therapy will be one and the same. Indeed, paying attention to how psychotherapeutic concepts, such as repression, defense mechanisms, projection, and repetition, show up at a societal level could bolster emancipatory struggles. And trying to comprehend and work through rather than deny our own insecurities, vulnerabilities and flaws is, at the very least, not amenable to the far right, which relies upon fantasies of supremacy and scapegoating. It could even be considered a kind of resistance. In the 1970s, East London Big Flame members experimented with group therapy as a means of, an antidote to the difficulties involved in, doing radical politics together, including in the women's movement and housing activism. Their leaderless groups, some women's, some men's, and some mixed gender, met regularly, acting as open forums for feelings, and sometimes they went on intensive, therapeutic weeks away. The group sought to actively address intra-group power dynamics and learned and shared their skills in therapeutic modalities such as co-counselling, guided fantasy, gestalt, regression, and somatic therapies such as massage. We see doing therapy in the ways we want to do it as part of the whole fight against capitalism's control over our lives, wrote the collective in the Red Therapy pamphlet where they documented their efforts. Therapy is much more than just making life tolerable so that we can fight better on other fronts. It is part of the long-term struggle to reclaim our own emotional and personal resources. Many groups today follow in the footsteps of such collaborative approaches to therapy. Hearts and Minds is a peer support group holding London-based and online sessions by and for young people with lived experience of mental health struggles or emotional distress. The sessions are informed by the theory of intentional peer support, which focuses on the power of mutual transformative relationships that support all people in the encounter to find new ways of thinking, seeing, and doing. Ultimately, the group is interested in social change, with transformative therapeutic spaces underpinning the system overhauls necessary to address the reasons why many people experience mental distress. Collective care beyond the state requires preparedness for mental health crises. Some radical mental health groups and therapeutic communities recommend creating crisis support plans. The Campaign for Psychiatric Abolition, for example, has written a document entitled How We Can Help Each Other During a Mental Health Crisis. In defiance of the medical model, its advice is informed by the principle that a person in crisis knows best what will help them. An individual's crisis support plan might include known warning signs that they are approaching crisis point, important boundaries such as not contacting estranged family members, words or actions that can help ground them, including harm reduction strategies, and named people or groups the crisis plan can be shared with. Such approaches aim to ensure people in extreme distress can be better supported by those around them, making institutionalization that could put them at risk of coercion, criminalization, and detention less likely. Radical therapy should be trauma-informed and based on values of transformative justice. This means acknowledging that people's feelings and behaviours are related to their past experiences rather than a consequence of some inherent brokenness or badness, including when they act in very challenging or even harmful ways. Understanding does not mean excusing. In Detransition Baby, a novel by Tori Peters, the protagonist Ames reflects upon how, during his final year living as a woman before detransitioning, he became sad and contemplative about how trans women treat each other. At the time, he recalls, his reflections were inspired by a real essay titled Elephant Breakdown in the science journal Nature. The article shows how a period of exceptional cruelty and violence by some juvenile elephants in the Hihaluyi Imfaluzi Game Reserve in South Africa could be explained not, as previously thought, by high levels of testosterone or competition for resources, but, as Peters writes, by a form of chronic stress, a species-wide trauma that has led to a total and ongoing breakdown of elephant culture. All three of the elephants ravaging life around them were from an orphan generation. Their elders had been mutilated and killed by humans before their eyes. All three had once been chained to the bodies of their dead and dying kin. Even in apparently radical approaches to care, the fact that lived trauma often begets inflicted trauma is rarely meaningfully incorporated. This can be true of activist groups too, including those with an apparent commitment to abolitionist principles. Often, a carceral logic of care, sometimes reiterating abuse through public harassment, shunning, and punishment, takes the place of transformative approaches that leave space for people to take responsibility for their behaviours and change. Surely, for any healing to happen, indeed for liberation to be possible, we must know ourselves and others to be both hurt and hurting harmed and harmful, and to be fluid, always capable of being otherwise. Well-being pending revolution. The softness of care rejects the hard systems that propagate suffering. Beyond vapid understandings of self-care and wellness, as defined by mostly rich white people, or forms of therapy that individualize suffering, we might find liberatory possibilities in looking after. It is most often people whose identities mean they fare relatively well in the world, and those unaccustomed to the feminized labor of caring, especially white cis straight men, who dismiss this idea as not urgent or necessary, not real politics. Those subject to more systemic trauma and violence know better. As Lord, a black lesbian living with a cancer diagnosis, wrote, "Caring for myself is not self-indulgence, it is self-preservation, and that is an act of political warfare." In another essay, Lord suggests black women can learn to mother ourselves, meaning, "I affirm my worth by committing myself to my own survival." Along with many other black revolutionaries, Lord insists upon the political power of caring for our own bodies and minds and for those of our comrades. Political organizing itself can be nurturing. From 1969, the Black Panther Party, the BPP, in the United States ran survival programs, including free breakfasts for children, medical clinics, self-defense and first aid classes, political education, transport to visit loved ones in prison, and addiction rehabilitation support. BPP co-founder Huey P. Newton described the rationale for these programs as follows. "We recognized that in order to bring the people to the level of consciousness where they would seize the time, it would be necessary to serve their interests in survival by developing programs which would help them to meet their daily needs. All these programs satisfy the deep needs of the community, but they are not solutions to our problems. That is why we call them survival programs, meaning survival pending revolution." In meeting people's needs, the BPP aimed not only to keep them alive and well, but to get them to understand the true reasons why they are in need in such an incredibly rich land, so they might fight back. In this way, political organizing, whether for quality social housing, for police abolition, or against government cuts, can be both a way of improving material conditions and a form of self and collective care. Fighting for the freedom to be well is not all about doing, however. Sometimes it is about refusing to do what capitalism expects. For example, the Bare Minimum Collective, a group of black feminists, queer theorists and creatives, many of whom are disabled, believes in doing nothing, or at the very least, as little as is required of us, space for pleasure, and the abolition of everything but care, mutual aid, and community. Either because our bodies won't allow us, because of disability, illness, exhaustion, to do more, or because we have conflicting responsibilities in caring for others, or desires for idleness, art, indulgence, sometimes resistance, or simply existence, means doing only what we need to do to stay and feel alive. World changing takes many forms. In sick woman theory, Johanna Hedver proposes that for those who carry the trauma of our current regime of neoliberal, white supremacist, imperial capitalist, cis heteropatriarchy, most modes of political protest are internalized, lived, embodied, suffering, and no doubt invisible. They ask, how do you throw a brick through the window of a bank if you can't get out of bed? Contrary to patriarchal conceptions of revolution, caring for ourselves and each other can be the most anti-capitalist protest because once we are all ill and confined to the bed, sharing our stories of therapies and comforts, forming support groups, bearing witness to each other's tales of trauma, prioritizing the care and love of our sick, pained, expensive, sensitive, fantastic bodies, and there is no one left to go to work, perhaps then, finally, capitalism will screech to its much-needed, long-overdue, and motherfucking glorious halt. We must collectively seize wellness as a common good and reimagine it. We must recognize that suffering and the resources to feel better are unevenly distributed by design. Our hidden agonies can become fuel to burn it all down. We must rebuild by transforming the ways in which the world is psychically destructive and facilitates violence, and organize instead for communalized care. Our tending to each other will overcome alienation and galvanize resistance. We must imagine life beyond the lonely slog and find utopian moments of living otherwise that help us know it is possible. In seeking solace, let's give ourselves permission, as Kate Bornstein advises in Hello, Cruel World, 101 Alternatives to Suicide for Teens, Freaks, and Other Outlaws, to do anything that makes life more worth living, whilst attempting to follow one simple rule. Don't be mean.